1330 WEBY, Northwest Florida's Talk Radio. This is Your Turn, a live call-in show featuring spirited discussion and debate about issues that matter to the community. Your Turn is sponsored by People's First Community Bank, the best bank in the neighborhood. Stay with us to hear what Northwest Florida thinks. Better yet, call in at 623-1330 and tell us what you think. It's your turn here on 1330 WEBY, Northwest Florida's Talk Radio. Now, here's the host of Your Turn.
We've only got an hour left of this version of Your Turn, the program that I've dubbed Meeting Nonsense with Common Sense. My name's Renee Giacchino. I'm corporate counsel for the Center for Individual Freedom, and I want to thank you for tuning in, and hopefully you'll stay tuned for the remaining hour of this program. Well, all eyes seem to be on Wall Street in New York, and some folks may not realize that they've turned the lights on First Street in Washington, D.C. That's because today marks the opening of the new Supreme Court term. A lot of folks are already calling this a ho-hum term, maybe indicating that the Roberts Court's fourth term may be a little less interesting than in previous years. And by interesting, I think they mean controversial or socially divisive. Here to help us navigate through this, talk a little bit about some of the cases that are on the docket, cases that may be coming onto the docket, is the Center for Individual Freedom's own Director of Legal and Public Affairs. Please welcome back Tim Lee. Tim, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me, Renee. It definitely, at first glance, doesn't have a lot of the sort of sexy cases that last term had. The Second Amendment case, I think, was the leading one that got people's blood boiling on both ends of the spectrum. But there are still a few ones that are certainly noteworthy, and I think the first one I'll discuss will get a few people's blood boiling.
All right, what do you pick at the top of the list? I'm curious if we have the same one.
Well, I was going to say the one that will attract the most anger, I think, and stir up the most sort of anger amongst your listeners is the Winter versus Natural Resources Defense Council. This is a case out in California where the Navy was literally enjoined from exercising this sort of high-tech sonar that they had developed because it apparently interfered with whales. And so you had a Natural Resources Defense Council suing the Navy and winning in court. This was in the Ninth Circuit, which, as many of your listeners will know, is pretty much the craziest circuit in our Court of Appeals system. And they actually succeeded. And so here you have the Navy, which has developed this sonar technology that is able to spot these quieter diesel submarines that the Chinese now have. Well, they're enjoined from engaging in using it in training their officers in very critical training because of the whales. And so you essentially have a bunch of environmentalists that have successfully stopped the Navy from engaging in training for this type of new sonar that will be vitally necessary if we have that sort of sea war with the Chinese at some future date.
Well, I don't know, you know, that the whales know this or not, but I certainly do that, you know, we're engaged in war right now. I mean, I would hope that at times like that, you know, folks would recognize that we need to have available to us the best possible technology. And it sounds like what you're talking about is truly inhibiting our U.S. Navy from developing the best possible technology when it comes to sonar.
Well, you're absolutely right. And it's sort of another example of silly season in the courts. I think oftentimes they disregard national security, as illustrated, in my opinion, by last year's Guantanamo decisions and the enemy combatant decisions that grant habeas corpus rights to people who aren't even entitled to Geneva Convention protections. Sometimes after 9/11, I think we've developed such a sense of security, or at least some of us have, that we no longer realize that the danger is out there sometimes. And the Chinese, they're certainly not confronting us right now in a military fashion, but they're a growing power, and in the future, you know, they could be like Germany at the turn of the 19th to 20th century, you know, a growing country that thinks that it's not getting sufficient respect on the world scene, and they're developing their military, and who knows what lies down the road. But you're absolutely right. I think sometimes judges, especially in places like the Ninth Circuit, they're silly. They don't realize we're in the midst of a war and that these things are important, sometimes from the protection of a behind a bench or behind a black robe. Maybe sometimes they don't realize that everyday people are facing these threats, and sometimes it takes a 9/11 for them to realize it, but that's in the past now, and I think people are sort of taking for granted that we're now safe, and that's usually the first weakness that leads to a military confrontation or a catastrophe like 9/11 in the future, because people let down their guard, and this might be an example of that. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, the apathy. All right, so one of the cases the court will hear very soon, oral arguments, is whether the lower courts properly enjoin the use of sonar by the Navy in their training exercises, you know, whether or not the environmental impact to the whales should, in fact, take precedent over our need to develop this technology. All right, that wasn't the case I put at the top of my list, although that is a very interesting case. I actually had two kind of tied for the top of my list, the ones that I'm going to follow most probably more closely than some of the other ones. The first one has to do with, and maybe it's because I'm seated right here in the studio, but it's the Federal Communications versus Fox television stations, a challenge by the broadcasters to the FCC's policy on fleeting expletives. What can you tell us about that, Tim?
Well, fleeting expletives, as some of your audience might know, are instances in which, in these cases specifically, there was an awards show on NBC and Fox. They were airing a couple of awards shows, and we're not sure if that leads into more expletives than other programs, but we'll leave that to the listener's judgment. But in each case, fleeting expletives are where somebody is up there receiving an award, it's on live television, and you know, in their glee, or sometimes even planned, they, you know, utter an F-bomb. And they say something that they're not supposed to say on the air, and the network doesn't catch it, it gets through, and, you know, oftentimes it's in prime time. Another good illustration of this sort of thing, even though it wasn't an expletive, was the circumstance of the Super Bowl, where Justin Timberlake declothed Janet Jackson.
Right.
That was fleeting. It wasn't an expletive, but it was fleeting. And that's the circumstance that we're talking about here. And the question is, has the FCC sufficiently justified these regulations in an administrative manner? Some of the nitty-gritty of the case actually gets kind of boring, but you're right that these cases, I think, are the most visible, perhaps, to everyday listeners out there, because everybody's watched an Emmy Awards show or a Grammy Awards show or an Oscars show, and you know, sometimes these expletives seep through, and the FCC will find the station, and that's going to be the question in these cases, whether the FCC has sufficiently justified that. I think for a lot of people out there who really note the moral decay of society, I think this is going to be an important case to them, because, you know, we all don't want our kids watching smut on television. And, you know, if the FCC is going to be rebuked in this, and if our standards go down a little bit, who's to say what's on down the road? You know, today it's fleeting expletives. You know, I remember when there were words, and I won't name them now, obviously. But
well, the seven words of just look at Carlin's list.
Yeah, absolutely. And even more mild words than that, things you wouldn't say in polite company that you'll hear on primetime television nowadays. And you know, our standards go down, and the next thing you know, the F word's going to be allowed and everything else. So I think to a lot of people out there watching the cultural wars, this is going to be an important case to them. So you're absolutely right that this is another one of those flashpoint cases. I guess maybe the fleeting expletives didn't offend me as much as banning the Navy from using their sonar because it hurt the whales. But A lot of your listeners will probably agree, because people who follow the cultural wars will probably place a lot of emphasis on these cases.
Well, probably the one in the cultural war that's going to get the most emphasis, which was tied for my number one, is the Pleasant Grove City versus Sumam. What can you tell us about that Utah case?
Well, you know, very basically, a religious group wanted to place a monument in a public park where other private entities have been allowed to place monuments. You know, and so they were discriminated against. They're saying now that it was content-based, but the city said no, it was content-neutral because there was no similarity with the theme. Actually, that would make it content-based. But at any rate, the city is justifying that by saying, look, it wasn't really a public atmosphere. You wouldn't be allowed to otherwise have these monuments up. It's actually a very convoluted argument, and I think that the group has the better argument here, and they may win on this. But essentially, it boils down to a case in which a religious group wanted to place a monument in a public park, but it was a public park where other groups had been allowed to put up their monuments. And so you're right that a lot of people paying close attention to the cultural wars will have a problem with that as well, because it might demonstrate a greater and greater exclusion of things of religious importance, but things like the Ten Commandments, or In God We Trust, or the words Under God in the Pledge, that are slowly but surely being expunged from public discourse. And so you're right that that's another one that could get a lot of people's blood boiling. And then, there are a slew of other cases that probably aren't as visible in terms of, getting everybody excited, but could actually have a great deal of importance.
Well, I know right here in our front yard, the ACLU has engaged the local school district, and I think I've talked with you about this privately, in a separation of church and state battle. And how far do you think the court will go on the issue of separation of church and state? I mean, in this case, it sounds like the facts are pretty specific. Do you think they'll expand the opinion and give us a little more insight into what it means to have separation of church and state, or do you think they'll just stick to the facts on this one?
You know, I'd be inclined to say that they're more likely to stick to the facts of this particular case. The Roberts Court, while I certainly like Justice Roberts and agree with him ideologically in most cases, as well as Justice Alito, the Roberts Court has tended to demonstrate a desire for greater unanimity. And so they'll try to narrow their ruling sometimes so that you have fewer 5-4 decisions. Obviously, in many cases, that's unsuccessful. And a good example would be the Second Amendment case, the D.C. gun ban last year. In many cases, I think Justice Roberts, for better or for worse, aims for greater consensus. If he could get every decision to be 9-0, he would. And so to do that, you oftentimes have to limit the scope of the decision so that more people will join in the majority decision and it'll be less divided in terms of the vote number. So given that habit of Justice Roberts, I would suspect that it would be more narrowly tailored to the facts of the case, and it wouldn't be such a sweeping pro-religious or anti-religious ruling. It could be wrong, but given the trend so far with Justice Roberts, I think it would probably be more narrowed.
All right, appropriately so, you're giving deference by calling it the Roberts Court because, in fact, it is his fourth term as Chief of the U.S. Supreme Court. But as a practical matter, is this going to be another year of the Kennedy Court, do you think?
It was sort of like going from the Clinton administration to the Bush administration. We'd gone from the O'Connor Court to the Kennedy Court. You're absolutely right. He's essentially the pivotal vote in most of these cases, and when you do see a 5-4 decision, it's almost always with Justice Kennedy being the deciding vote. You've got four justices that are more liberal, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Justice Stevens, Justice Souter, and Justice Breyer. And then towards the right, on the more conservative side, you obviously have Justice Scalia, Justice Roberts, Justice Alito, and Justice Thomas. And then Anthony Kennedy, he tends to be more conservative, but not always. In the habeas corpus rulings with regard to Guantanamo Bay enemy combatant detainees, he sided with the liberals, obviously. So you're right that in name it's the Justice Roberts Court, but in fact it probably tends to be more of a Justice Kennedy Court. So that's a very good point. He's replaced Justice O'Connor as perhaps the most powerful person in the country.
All right, before we go to break, there's another case that I'm going to be watching very closely, as are a lot of folks. It's maybe a little bit more of a technical case, than a lot of people want to get into. But what can you tell me about this preemption case that the court's going to hear and the impact that it could have maybe on our tort system?
Well, I actually think these are some of the most interesting out there, but that's maybe because I'm a geeky lawyer. But these preemption cases, for the listeners out there who aren't as familiar with these terms, preemption refers to the fact that federal law, in many cases, preempts state law. And this is especially true with regard to commerce. You can understand that when the Founding Fathers established the Constitution, they didn't want 50 states being able to, well, they didn't envision 50 states at the time, but they didn't necessarily want each individual state to be able to oversee and govern and regulate commerce in a way that would interfere with greater interstate commerce. So, for instance, if New York has a law saying that you can't operate a truck longer than 10 feet, whereas Pennsylvania says you can have trucks up to 20 feet, well, that's going to interfere with interstate commerce because, what, are you going to switch trailers every time you cross state lines? Regulations like that that really inhibit the flow of free commerce across America were really sort of to be avoided amongst the founding fathers. So what they did is they created the Commerce Clause, which said that federal law will generally preempt state laws in many of these circumstances. And it's illustrated by a couple of these cases. One is Altria versus Good. The other is Wyeth versus Levine. The Altria case deals with cigarettes, and so a lot of your listeners may have heard of that. But what you essentially had were FCC standards saying that these cigarette companies could advertise their cigarettes as low tar or light, things of that sort. So you can imagine that a company, when it's told at the federal level something is allowed, and then they go out and they advertise in a manner that accords with federal law, only to be sued by some individual state, we've got a problem. And that's what happened in this case. You suddenly have the state of Maine saying that these terms like low tar and light cigarettes were deceptive, and so they allowed a class action at the state level saying that, you know, these were deceptive terms and they committed fraud, et cetera, et cetera. So the question before the court is going to be whether federal law preempts the ability of Maine and a bunch of tort lawyers and runaway jurors down there to go after these companies. And I obviously think the stronger argument is that federal law does preempt it, so that when the national government tells a company that certain terms are perfectly legitimate to use in advertisement, you can't have individual states across the country contradicting that, because it just creates this spaghetti bowl of regulations and laws, and that's going to interfere with commerce. And so hopefully the court comes down on the right side there. In the Wyeth case, this is another preemption case, and this deals with an anti-nausea drug and an injection via IV that was explicitly approved by the FDA. And then there was a plaintiff who took this drug and she got sick and said that, well, I should be able to sue you despite the fact that federal law has allowed it. So in this case, again, you can imagine if you're a drug manufacturer, and we all depend in large part, everybody knows somebody certainly that depends on some of these innovative drugs that are created in our drug industry. The federal government tells you that something's allowed, and so you put it out on the market only to have some state tort lawyer come after you on a class action there. Well, that's going to interfere with state commerce as well, and it's also going for interstate commerce as well, and it's obviously going to interfere with the ability of drug companies to produce these things, because they're going to be hit with these punitive damages and verdicts across the country based upon these varying standards, and it's unpredictable, and it just interferes too much with interstate commerce. And so it's another example of this preemption issue. The question before the court will be, does the national standard preempt the ability of state lawsuits to occur? So very important cases, and I know that to some people, you know, the word preemption may sound unfamiliar, and it may sound like a dry topic, but it's actually very, very interesting.
Well, it has significant, you know, daily implications for all of us. Absolutely. Tim, we need to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to continue our conversation about the Supreme Court, which began its term today. We'll be right back after this short break.
Now, back to your turn on 1330 WEBY, Northwest Florida's Talk Radio. The phone lines are open, so call in and join the conversation at 623-1330.
All right, we've just got a couple minutes left to talk about the Supreme Court's new term, which began today, and some indications are that it's going to be a quiet year, but as Tim and I have been discussing, Tim is the Center for Individual Freedom's Director of Legal and Public Affairs, I think it's going to be anything but quiet. All right, Tim, I think one of the things that folks are watching very closely when you talk about the Supreme Court has more to do with the presidential race, and that's because the race could shape the court for years to come. We've had that conversation. You know, they're not getting any younger, and it's very likely that our next president will have an opportunity to nominate at least 2, 3, 4. What do you think, Tim?
I would say most likely 3. I think it's going to depend on who wins, though. If McCain wins, I think some of the older
liberal
judges they'll try to stick it out. Justice Stevens, my recollection is he's going to be 89 coming up soon, and so he obviously can't stay on the court a whole lot longer. I think he's the most likely to drop off. And when I say drop off, I don't mean that in a macabre manner. I think retire or, you know, step aside. He's getting up there. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg is going to be getting into her 80s. Justice Breyer is getting up there. So, you know, and Justice Kennedy as well. Some of them are younger. Justice Thomas is a bit younger. Justice Alito and Justice Roberts are obviously a bit younger. Justice Scalia, I believe, is 67 right now. I could be a little bit off on that. But a lot of them are getting older. I think if you see Obama win, you know, maybe some of them will drop off thinking, well, okay, now I can at least be replaced by another liberal. But if McCain wins, they might think, well, I'll try to hang on for another 4 years until another Democrat might possibly be in office and will appoint a more liberal justice. So I think the likelihood is for more openings. If Obama wins, if McCain wins, I think you'll see a lot of people trying to hold on, and so they'll get a more liberal president. But, this could be the most pivotal aspect of this election. A lot of my friends who, you know, they don't really get excited about voting one way or the other. I just say to them, look, Supreme Court justices alone makes this a very, very important election. Then you talk about the lower court appointments, the circuit court appointments. Judges are always a critical issue. So for the listeners out there who otherwise aren't really that interested in it and might think it's kind of a boring election, the courts alone make it an important election because there's so many of these critical issues that are up there. The court is very closely balanced. As you said earlier, Justice Kennedy is essentially the deciding vote in almost anything controversial. This is very important, and whoever is president is going to be able to appoint some people and make it a very, very critical election.
All right, you're right across the Potomac. We've got about 30 seconds left. Are there names being floating around out there yet from either of the candidates, their short list of folks they might? I mean, I think I read something today that Hillary may be on the short list should Obama become our next president. Think that's true?
You know, I've heard that a little bit. I've heard both Bill and Hillary Clinton as possible appointees for for President Obama if he's elected. You hear less discussion with regard to Senator McCain if he's elected. I think he's getting a little bit more under wraps. But, you know, right now, I don't know if some of the listeners are paying close attention, but sometimes when I hear Bill Clinton or Hillary Clinton speak, I almost get the sense that they're voting for McCain and Palin. Their endorsements of Obama are certainly much more lukewarm than you might otherwise expect, and so perhaps Obama speaks with them secretly.
It's going to be interesting. All right, Tim, that's all the time we have. Thanks so much. We appreciate you coming on again to talk about the Supreme Court's new term. We'll be right back after this break.